Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Kings chapter 8. I am going to do the entire chapter today, verses 1 through 29. Our context is this. We're in the middle of the exploits of Elisha. Elisha mainly operated during the reign of King Joram of northern Israel, who reigned from 852 to 841. In our last chapter, our context, we saw the Syrian army besieging Israel, and Elisha makes the bold prediction that in one day people will go from eating donkey's heads and eating dove's dung to eating barley and wheat at a normal price, because the Syrian army was hoodwinked by Yahweh, who made somehow a sound of armies approaching ring in the Syrians' ears, and as a result, the Syrians panicked and fled camp. So we now start with 2 Kings chapter 8, verses 1 through 6. Now Elisha spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, that's the Shunammite woman, saying, "Arise and go with your household and sojourn wherever you can sojourn, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will even come on the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines 7 years. At the end of 7 years, the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went out to appeal to the king for her house and for her field." This is King Joram. "Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, 'Please relate to me all the great things that Elisha has done,' as he was relating to the king how he had restored to life the one who was dead, namely the son of the Shunammite woman. Behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and her field." A divine coincidence there, divine providence. "And Gehazi said, 'My lord, O king, this is the woman and this is her son, whom Elisha restored to life.' When the king asked the woman, she related it to him. So the king appointed for her a certain officer, saying, 'Restore all that was hers and all the produce of the field from the day that she left the land even until now.'" In verse 1, we see that Elisha spoke to the woman. Clark and Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that it should be translated as "had spoken to the woman," because this is a relation of event far past, because the raising of the son of the Shunammite woman happened before the famine, and there's been 7 years of famine. Notice the 7 years is double the famine that happened in the days of Elijah, when he prayed for 3.5 years that it not rain, and then it would rain after 3.5 years. So things are still tough in northern Israel. They are rebelling against the Lord, and famine was the promise of God in the curses, Deuteronomy 28 and 29, spoken from Mount Ebal to the Israelites. You keep doing idolatry, bad things are going to happen. And this illustrates another principle. In the midst of judgment, God will take his people who are in the land that's being judged, and he will protect them and send them to where there is sustenance. There's lots of examples of this, and this is another example, the Shunammite woman. The application today, of course, is for all of those Americans who are fearing the judgment of God coming on America for our condign sins. God will take you to where you will be protected. Now, it might not be in the same place where you are now. You might have to go somewhere, but he will protect his own. And the woman is smart enough to know that when Elisha speaks from God. And so she immediately did exactly according to what Elisha had said. And so she lives and goes in the land of the Philistines. That wasn't too far away. It was to the west, south and west of where she was in Shunem. Shunem was in the Jezreel Valley in the tribe of Manasseh near the northern parts of Israel. Turns out there's plenty of food. The interesting thing about famines in the ancient world, they had no transportation. So all the weather had to do was change just a little bit in one small area, and those people would be in bad shape. And then all they have to do is go to another place where the rain was falling, and they wouldn't be in bad shape. With the advent of refrigerated freight cars, the fear of famine, most places in the world, in the advanced industrialized world, famine is a thing of the past, because if there's not rain falling in one area, the refrigerated train cars will bring food from another area. But they didn't have that back then. Now, she went to the land of the Philistines, the Shunammite woman did. She could exercise her religion, her worship of Yahweh, as freely there as she could in idolatrous Israel, because in Israel, everybody's worshiping golden calves and Baals and Astartes. At this time, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the Philistine state had been greatly reduced. So there was less risk from the seductions of idolatry, actually. So things were actually easier for her religiously in the land of the Philistines. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown also say that there were many Israelites and Judahites, Jews from the north and Jews from the south, who were living in the land of the Philistines there. So she was all right. She goes there for 7 years. But she comes back and her house is gone. Now, why had the Shunammite lost her house? Here's some speculations. Perhaps her nearest relations had seized them in her absence. Or maybe she had entrusted the property to someone who refused to return it. Or maybe she forfeited the land to the king for leaving the land without permission. Now, that was not provided for in the law of Moses, but it seems to have been adopted as a law in Israel. But for whatever reason, she didn't have her house. Notice how God providentially takes care of her. Gehazi's telling Joram about all the stuff that Elisha's done, and up walks the Shunammite woman. I say up walks, she probably had to appeal to some courtiers, to some bureaucrats to get through to the king, but she did. Now, this is the same Gehazi that used to be the attendant of Elisha, so he would know all about Elisha's deeds. But you remember he got fired by Elisha because he had chased down Naaman, whom Elisha had just told how to get healed by Yahweh. And Elisha had sent Naaman off, the Syrian general Naaman, off without taking money from Naaman. And Gehazi had chased Naaman down and says, "Give me some money." And Elisha was not happy about such greed, and so Gehazi was booted. But this apparently is before that. The king is not going to be talking to a disgraced, leprous man, because remember, Gehazi got leprosy for his sin. Davidson, Fawcett, and Brown disagree with that. They say that the king could be talking with Gehazi at a distance. Well, I don't think so. Notice how when the king restores the Shunammite woman's land, that once again, this woman's kindness to Elijah is still paying off way in her future. Elisha has prayed for her to have a son. She had a son. The son got sunstroke and almost died. Elisha prays for the son to be restored. Now, the woman is in a famine. Elisha says, "This is where you go to get out of the famine." She loses her house, and Elisha gets her house back, or at least Gehazi gets the house back, Elisha's servant. So that woman, by showing kindness to a prophet of God, was blessed all of her entire life. We go down to 2 Kings 8, 7 through 14. Then Elisha came to Damascus. Damascus, of course, is the capital of Syria, right to the northeast of Israel. We don't know why Elisha's there. We're going to look at some options in just a minute. Now, Ben-Hadad, that's Ben-Hadad II, ruled 860 to 841 B.C., king of Aram, of course that's Syria, king of Aram, was sick, and it was told him, saying, "The man of God has come here," that's Elisha, "has come here." The king, Ben-Hadad II, said to Hazael, now Hazael's going to take over after Ben-Hadad II. We'll see this in this chapter. Ben-Hadad II ruled from 860 to 841. Hazael ruled from 841 to 801, so he was around for a long time. So Ben-Hadad II said to Hazael, "Take a gift in your hand." Now Hazael is probably an attendant, perhaps the chief military guy after Naaman had died or had been deposed. So Ben-Hadad II, the king, says to Hazael, "Take a gift in your hand and go to meet the man of God." You'll meet Elisha and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, "Will I recover from this sickness?" So Hazael went to meet Elisha and took a gift in his hand, even every kind of good thing of Damascus, 40 camel's loads. And Hazael came and stood before Elisha and said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to you, saying, 'Will I recover from this sickness?'" Then Elisha said to Hazael, "Go say to Ben-Hadad II, 'You will surely recover, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die.'" Elisha fixed his gaze steadily on Hazael until Hazael was ashamed, and the man of God wept. Hazael said, "Why does my Lord weep?" Then he answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the sons of Israel. Their strongholds you will set on fire, and their young men you will kill with the sword, and their little ones you will dash in pieces, and their women with child you will rip up." Then Hazael said, "But what is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing?" And Elisha answered, "The Lord has shown me that you will be king over Aram." So Hazael departed from Elisha and returned to his master Ben-Hadad II, who said to Hazael, "What did Elisha say to you?" And Hazael answered, "He told me that you would surely recover." In verse 7, Elisha comes to Damascus. Why? Well, the Jews say, the rabbis say, he came there to convert Gehazi. Now, where they get that from, I don't know. The rabbis are quite imaginative. I doubt very seriously that's why Elisha came to Damascus. Another speculation, he may have come to support Naaman, who might have been kicked out of his office for his new faith. We talked about the question of, did Naaman actually keep going into the idol temple? Rimmon is the Syrian idol god. Did Naaman keep going into that temple and offering worship then after he said he was going to serve Yahweh? That's controversial. It's unclear. But he obviously is happy with Yahweh now, and so some people speculate that the pagan Ben-Hadad II kicked him out of his office. And John Gill points out, in fact, Hazael is now captain of the army. Well, that's a speculation. Another speculation is that Elisha wanted to declare that Hazael would be king. We know from 1 Kings 19:15 that Elijah, not Elisha, but Elijah is to anoint Hazael as king. 1 Kings 19:15, the Lord said to him, this is when Elijah is at Mount Sinai, having run from Ahab and Jezebel. The Lord said to Elijah, go return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you have arrived, you shall anoint Hazael king over Aram. Now that's Elijah, not Elisha. Well, Hazael started ruling in 841, so from this I assume that Elijah continued his prophetic ministry from the time of Ahab, Ahab's son Ahaziah, Ahab's son Joram, and Joram died in 841, and so did Ben-Hadad II, and so this is right around 841, at the end of Elijah's life and the beginning of Hazael's reign, that Elijah anointed him as king. But Elisha could have been there at the same time with Elijah. We don't know. All of this is speculation, but for whatever reason, Elisha is in Damascus. The king, Ben-Hadad II, we've seen him for a long time. He ruled from 860 to 841. He's sick. He hears that Elisha's in town, and of course, Elisha's exploits would have been known by now in Syria. Remember, Naaman had been healed of leprosy by Elisha, and plus his reputation had probably spread outside of Israel. Syria is not that far away. And so the king says, Hazael, go ask him, will I recover? You wonder why he didn't just ask Hazael to ask Elisha to pray for Ben-Hadad II's total recovery. Why not ask for a healing instead of a prediction? Well, it could be because Ben-Hadad II is used to prophets and wise men making predictions, but not praying for healing. I mean, all through the Roman Empire, people looking to the guts of birds to try to figure out who's going to win the battle. So predictions of what these holy men did back then, and that's probably all he expected of Elisha. So Hazael, verse 9, goes down and takes a gift to Elisha. Says he took a gift in his hand, 40 camel's loads. Well, that doesn't mean that he carried 40 camel's loads of gifts in his hand. That's the NESB translation. The Holman Christian Study Bible translation just says he took a gift, which I think is a much less misleading translation. 40 camel's loads. Now, that's a lot of gift. Now, Adam Clark says, or Jameson Fawcett and Brown say that, quote, the Orientals are fond of display and would, ostentatiously, lay upon 40 beasts what might very easily have been borne by four. Spread the gifts out and walked in with 40 camels. Well, did Elisha take that money? The text doesn't actually say he received the gift. If he did take the gift, that would be contrary to what he did with Naaman. He refused Naaman's gift. And when we discussed that issue, I said, I think the reason that he refused Naaman's gift is Naaman's gift was so large. The prophets would take support, food, and things just to keep them going, but to make themselves rich, they wouldn't take money. And here, 40 camels worth, even if the stuff was spread out, that might look bad. So I suspect that Elisha didn't take the money here. It doesn't say that he did. So Hazael says to Elisha, your son Ben-Hadad, king of Aram, has sent me to you. Your son? Ben-Hadad II is the son of Elisha. Well, that's just a polite way of talking, a mark of respect. Now we get to verse 10, and we're going to have a little bit of trouble here. Elisha says to Hazael, go say to Ben-Hadad II, you will surely recover, but the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die. What? Is Elisha telling Hazael to lie to Ben-Hadad II? How could a prophet of God enjoin somebody to lie? And for what purpose? Well, let's look at that thorny problem. I've got about four possible solutions. The first solution, and this is from Ellicott and from the Pulpit Commentary, maybe some others. This solution says that Elisha knows that Hazael is going to lie to Ben-Hadad II anyway, because Hazael is going to kill him, most probably kill him. And even if he's not planning to kill him, you know how bad it is when the messenger brings bad news in the ancient worlds. A lot of times the messenger is killed. You hate the message, you kill the messenger. And so Elisha, according to this theory, knows that that's exactly what's going to happen. Hazael is not going to give bad news to his king. And so he sarcastically and ironically says, yeah, tell him you'll surely recover. I know you're going to do that anyway, so go ahead and tell him you'll surely recover. But I'm telling you something that you're not going to tell him. He's going to die. That's a reasonable answer, I think. Here's option number two. Elisha, when he tells Hazael the words that Hazael is to give to Ben-Hadad, the words are not you will surely recover, but that you might recover. Now, that's the way the King James actually has it. 2 Kings 8:10 in King James, and Elisha said unto him, unto Hazael, go say unto Ben-Hadad, thou mayest certainly recover. There's certainly in there, but then there's the mayest in there too. Well, I looked through all my translations. They all have, you will surely recover, you will certainly recover. Go tell Ben-Hadad II, you got it made, you're going to live, you'll surely recover, you'll certainly recover. The Young's Literal Translation, which is a literal translation, has surely recover. So that's weak. We're not going to go with the King James Translation. Another problem with King James Translation, if Hazael says, Ben-Hadad, you might recover, what kind of a prophecy is that from Elisha? I could have said that. Yeah, you might recover. That says nothing. Anybody might recover. So that's not a good option as to why Elisha tells Hazael what he told him. So here's option number three. The translation should be, you shall not recover. In other words, Elisha tells Hazael, go tell Ben-Hadad you shall not recover, but you will certainly die. Well, that makes sense logically. The problem is that the translation is very iffy. Benson suggests that translation, but Kyle and Delitch in the Pulpit Commentary deny that translation, and I don't know a word of Hebrew except shalom, and so I can't say whether that's a good solution or not. Here's the fourth possible solution. Elisha tells Hazael to tell Ben-Hadad, hey, Ben-Hadad, you're going to recover from this illness, but you're going to die in another way. Not from the illness, but you're going to die anyway from something else. So the verse would read like this. Go, Hazael, say to Ben-Hadad, you will surely recover, but the Lord has shown me that you're going to certainly die. But the Lord has shown Elisha that you're going to die. You got to shift the pronouns a little bit to come up with that. You also have to assume that the whole phrase there is going to be reported to Ben-Hadad. The way the NASB has the quotations is, go say to Ben-Hadad, you will surely recover. And that's bracketed in quotation marks, single quotation marks, close quotation marks. And then Elisha speaks to Hazael, private words to Hazael that are not supposed to be reported to Ben-Hadad. But the Lord has shown me that he will certainly die. So, Hazael, he's going to die. So the only thing that Elisha, according to this view, according to the quotation marks in the NASB, the only thing that Hazael is supposed to tell Ben-Hadad II is, you're going to recover. But privately, Elisha tells Hazael, you're going to die. But if we take solution number four, that Elisha is saying to Ben-Hadad II, you're going to recover from the illness, but you're going to die another way, you'd have to change the quotation mark so that Elisha would mean that the whole sentence would be relayed to Ben-Hadad II. You're going to recover, and the second part, you're going to die. I don't think that's really the way we ought to go with that. Well, I think the best way to explain this is Elisha's being ironic and sarcastic. Yeah, go tell him he's going to recover. I know you're not going to, but go tell him if that's what you want to do. But I'm telling you, he's going to die. That basically saves Elisha from the charge that he has made an exhortation to lie. And how can a man of God, a prophet, do something like that? Verse 11, Elisha starts staring at Hazael, gazing steadily at him, until Hazael got ashamed and Elisha started crying. Here's what Clark says about Elisha. Quote, he had a murderer before him, and he saw the bloody acts he was about to commit and was greatly distressed, but he endeavored to conceal his feelings. At last his face reddened with anguish. His feelings overcame him, and he burst out and wept. And Haziel didn't cry, but he became ashamed to be stared at like that. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say of Haziel, quote, The steadfast, penetrating look of the prophet seems to have convinced Haziel that his secret designs were known. What secret designs? Well, he's getting ready to bump off his boss, Ben-Hadad II. Now, Elisha, in verse 12, prophesies all the evil that Haziel is going to do to Israel. He states that evil very eloquently. Strongholds set on fire, young men killed with swords, little one dashed in pieces, women with child ripped up, pregnant women ripped up. Let's look at some of the evil that Haziel did later on after he takes over in 841. Some of the evil he did, 2 Kings 10:32-33, in those days the Lord began to cut off portions from Israel, and Haziel defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. From the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites and the Reubenites and the Manassites, from Aroer, which is by the valley of Arnon, even Gilead and Bashan. That's basically all of the Transjordan area from north to south. Manasseh, Gad, Reuben. I won't go through the geography, but that's what we're talking about here. 2 Kings 13:3, so the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he gave them continually into the hand of Haziel, king of Aram, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Haziel. That's a different Ben-Hadad. So Haziel's still wiping them out here. 2 Kings 13:7, Jehoahaz, that's the later king of Israel, did not have an army left except for 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers, because the king of Aram had destroyed them, making them like dust at threshing. So Elisha was right. Haziel is going to really do a number on the northern Israelites, again, because of the northern Israelites' idolatry. Now, Haziel, when he hears that he's going to be ripping up pregnant women of Israel and killing the soldiers and burning the cities, he says, how am I going to do such a great thing? Am I a dog to do that? Well, there's two ways you can take that. He could be saying, Elisha, are you saying that I'm going to be so cruel that I'm going to rip up pregnant women, etc.? Or you could take it this way. I'm just a dog. I don't have any authority. I'm not a king. I'm just a mere military commander. I'm just a servant of the king. Well, he was cruel and he was a hypocrite because he ended up having authority by killing the king. I think he's just bristling with hypocrisy here. He's feigning modesty. I'm just a dog. I'm not a big shot in Syria. I'm not going to be killing Israel. I don't think he's talking about his cruelty. I think he's talking about his power. He's saying, I don't have any power. I'm a modest man, which is a joke, of course. So Elisha tells Haziel that he's going to be king over Aram. Haziel departs, goes back to Ben-Hadad II, and he tells him, Elisha told me that you are going to recover Ben-Hadad II. He didn't tell him the second part, which is, Elisha also told me, you're going to die. He didn't get into that. He just said, you're going to surely recover, which is what I think Elisha knew he was going to do all along. That's why he gave him that sarcastic answer, which has confused people into thinking that Elisha may have exhorted a man to tell a lie. We go down to 2 Kings 8:15. On the following day, Haziel took the cover and dipped it in water and spread it on Ben-Hadad II's face so that he died. And Haziel became king in his place. That was in 841. He ruled for 40 years to 801. Now, there's a couple of options on how Haziel killed Ben-Hadad II. He either suffocated him on purpose or Ben-Hadad just accidentally died. Let's assume that he did it on purpose, which is what I believe he did. He could have ordered a wet cloth to be laid on Ben-Hadad II's face to allay the heat and the fever that was afflicting Ben-Hadad. And then he could have just taken that wet cloth and put it over Ben-Hadad's nose and suffocated him. Ben-Hadad's sick, he can't fight back. Or he could have been crafty about it, or he could have just come in there and just suffocated him, put the cloth on his face. If it was goat's hair that was the cover, goat's hair would hold a lot of water, and then you put all that water on top of him, drips down into his mouth and nostrils and basically waterboards him. He's finished. And also, there wouldn't be any suspicious marks left over. Now, we should allow for the possibility that this death of Ben-Hadad II was not a murder, but it was merely an accident that occurred during the attendant's ministrations to the king because of his sickness. Anyway, however he did it, Hazael is now king, and we'll be meeting him as we go through the rest of the book of 2 Kings. We go now to 2 Kings 8, verses 16 through 19. Now in the fifth year of Joram, that's 852 to 841, when he ruled, he's the northern king Joram, the son of Ahab. Ahab had two sons. Ahaziah, the first one, fell through the lattice, ruled 853 to 852. Then Joram, the second ruled, the second son ruled from 852 to 841. So in the fifth year of Joram, son of Ahab, Jehoshaphat, being then the king of Judah, now Jehoshaphat ruled from 87 to 848, and Joram, the northern king Joram, started ruling in 852, so that's the four-year period that's being talked about here. So Jehoshaphat being then the king of Judah, the last 4 years of Jehoshaphat coincided with the first 4 years of Joram, 4 or 5 years. Now, in that fifth year, which is 841, is 848. In that fifth year of Joram, Joram starts ruling in 852, so 5 years from there will be right around 848. Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, became king. Now, we need to distinguish in this one verse, Joram, who is the king in the north, the northern Israelite king, Joram, and Jehoram is the southern king, the son of Jehoshaphat. So Joram in the north, son of Ahab, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat in the south. This is complicated because some translations translate Joram in the north as Jehoram, and that really gets things confusing. And so I'm going to make it a point to distinguish the two kings, Joram in the north, Jehoram in the south. Verse 17, Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, just as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab became his wife. Now, who's the daughter of Ahab? That's Athaliah. Athaliah was the sister of Joram, Ahab's second son, who was king of the north from 852 to 841. And Athaliah is the sister of Ahaziah, who fell through the lattice. So Athaliah leaves the northern kingdom. She moves from Samaria to Jerusalem, and she marries Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat. Her influence caused Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, to walk in the same way that the kings of Israel did, i.e. into idolatry. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. Of course, evil in these books, in these historical books, evil means idolatry. Verse 19, however, the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David his servant, since he had promised to give David a lamp to him through his sons always. Now I said Athaliah was the daughter of Ahab, and she was the sister of Ahaziah and Joram. How did she end up marrying a southern king of Judah? She was given in marriage to Jehoram of Judah, the son of Jehoshaphat. She was given to Jehoram in a marriage alliance between Ahab of the north and Jehoshaphat of the south. Ahab and Jehoshaphat became good buddies, allies. They fought together against Aram at the Battle of Ramoth-Gilead, where Ahab got killed with a stray arrow, went through the crack in his armor. We read about this marriage alliance in 2 Chronicles 18:1. Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance, and he made an alliance with Ahab through marriage. That was the alliance. Athaliah and Jehoram. Ahab took his daughter Athaliah, and Jehoshaphat took his son Jehoram and married them off. Now notice in verse 18 the word for. Jehoram walked in the ways of the kings of Israel for, or because, the daughter of Ahab became his wife. So she did it. She led him into it. Eve led Adam into eating the apple. Jezebel led Ahab into putting Baal and Astarte idols up all over Israel. Solomon's wives, same thing. They led him into idolatry. The moral of this story is don't marry a pagan woman. Men will do anything to please their wives, just like Adam tried to please Eve. When you please your wife and your wife is an idolater, bad things happen. Now Jehoram in verse 18 is said to have done evil in the sight of the Lord. Let's read some of his evil. We'll hop over into 2 Chronicles to pick up some of the story there. 2 Chronicles 21:11, Jehoram also built high places in the hills of Judah, and he caused the inhabitants of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves, and he led Judah astray. Now, he's not talking about physical prostitution. He's talking about idol prostitution. These high places, I'm sure, were not for Yahweh. They were for other pagan idols like Baal and Astarte. 2 Chronicles 21:4, when Jehoram had established himself over his father's kingdom, he strengthened his position by killing with the sword all his brothers as well as some of the princes of Israel. So Jehoshaphat had a lot of sons, but Jehoram says, I'm not going to take a chance on any of those sons taking over my kingdom, so he just killed them all. Now we will read about how the northern prophet Elijah actually did some work down here in the south in his never-ending ministry of rebuking evil. In 2 Chronicles 21:12-15, we read this, Then a letter came to Jehoram from Elijah the prophet, saying, This is what Yahweh, the God of your ancestor David, says, Because you have not walked in the ways of your father Jehoshaphat or in the ways of Asa king of Judah, but have walked in the way of the kings of Israel. Remember, Jehoshaphat and Asa were good kings, got rid of the idols. But you have walked in the way of the kings of Israel, Jehoram, and you have caused Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to prostitute themselves like the house of Ahab prostituted itself. And again, that's not physical prostitution, that's idolatrous prostitution. And Jehoram, because you have killed your brothers, your father's family, I just read that, killed all the brothers when he took over the throne so the brothers wouldn't give him any competition. Because you've killed all your brothers who were better than you, Yahweh is now about to strike your people, your sons, your wives, and all your possessions with a horrible affliction. You yourself will be struck with many illnesses, including a disease of the intestines, until your intestines come out day after day because of the disease. Intestines coming out sounds like a bad case of hemorrhoids. I don't know, but it's what it sounds like. Those intestines probably came out of Jehoram's anus. Oh, my gosh, what punishment. Jehoram was a really bad king. You know, there's bad kings and then there's really bad kings. Jehoram was a very, very bad king. We'll see the results of his evil in 2 Chronicles 21:16-19, first part of verse 19. The Lord put it into the mind of the Philistines, and the Arabs who lived near the Cushites to attack Jehoram. The Cushites are probably the Ethiopians. The Arabs lived all around there, south of Ethiopia or around Ethiopia. Maybe in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula across the Red Sea from Ethiopia. I don't know, but it's some Arabs and some Philistines attacked Jehoram. Verse 17, 2 Chronicles 21. So they went to war against Judah and invaded it. The Philistines and the Arabs did. The Philistines and the Arabs carried off all the possession found in Jehoram's palace, and also his sons and wives. Not a son was left to him except Jehoaz, which is another name for Ahaziah, as some of the other translations have it. So Jehoahaz is left to Jehoram, Jehoahaz being Jehoram's youngest son. After all these things, the Lord afflicted him in his intestines with an incurable disease. This continued day after day until 2 full years passed. Then his intestines came out because of his disease, and he died from severe illnesses, just like Elijah had foretold by sending him a letter. It came to pass. He paid no attention to the letter, and he paid for it with his intestines. Verse 19 says this, The Lord was not willing to destroy Judah because of Jehoram being such a jerk, such an idolater. Why was the Lord not willing to destroy Judah? For the sake of David his servant, since he had promised David to give a lamp to him through his sons always. Well, it was not because of David's merits that Judah was not destroyed. It was rather because of God's promise. David was a murderer and an adulterer. It wasn't because of David's righteousness that God decided to give Judah a break despite evil King Jehoram's sins. No, it's not because of that. It's because of God's promise to David. Let's read about that promise. This is from Nathan the prophet, very famous passage which is quoted many thousands of times. Anybody studying the Old Testament? 2 Samuel 7:16. Nathan tells David, Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever. Your throne shall be established forever. And that forever means as long as the old covenant lasts, which means all the way till 586 BC when the kingdom was wiped out by the Babylonians. And remember, forever means a long time. Olam, it doesn't necessarily mean eternally. It just means a long time. Psalm 132:11. The Lord swore an oath to David, a promise he will not abandon. I will set one of your descendants on your throne. Psalm 132:17, There I will make a horn grow for David. I have prepared a lamp for my anointed one. So it's because of God's covenant promises to David that that the house of Judah was not wiped out, at least not yet. We go down to 2 Kings 8:20-22. during Jehoram's reign. Now remember, Jehoram ruled in the south, son of Jehoshaphat. He ruled from 848 to 841. During Jehoram's reign, Edom rebelled against Judah's control and appointed their own king. So Jehoram crossed over to Zaire with all his chariots. Then at night he set out to attack the Edomites who had surrounded him and the chariot commanders. He attacked the Edomites and he attacked the chariot commanders, the Edomite chariot commanders. But his troops fled to their tent. That's probably the Israelites' troops fled to their tents. In other words, they failed. Being surrounded, they failed to break out. And so the Edomites continued in their rebellion and quit paying tribute to Israel. Verse 22, so Edom is still in rebellion against Judah's control today. And again, Jeremiah probably wrote Kings. Jeremiah wrote in the 6th century before the destruction of the temple and the burning of Jerusalem in 586 by the Babylonians. So Edom had been subjected by David, and Edom had been paying tribute, but they rebelled here under Jehoram, and they became free of tribute and control. Libna also rebelled at that time. Libna is another city. It was a Levitical city of considerable size. It revolts. I don't know whether it was Israelites in Libna who revolted or whether it was pagans that had taken over Libna to revolt. I'm not really sure. The name Libna means transparency or whiteness. Here's what Easton says about that place. Well, first of all, where was it? Well, nobody knows exactly where it was. Somewhere southwest of Jerusalem, probably just northeast of Lachish, which is a famous city down southwest of Jerusalem in Philistine territory. Libna later became besieged by the Assyrian king, not the Syrian king, but the Assyrian king Sennacherib, which we'll read about later on in 2 Kings when we'll get to chapter 19. Libna was the native place of Hamutal, the queen of Josiah. Interesting, a little factoid. Libna stood near Lachish. Okay. So Libna rebels. Also, Edom rebelled, and the place of the battle between the Israelites and the Edomites was Zaire. It sounds like a place in Africa. Zaire is the same as Zoar, Z-O-A-R, which is right south of the Dead Sea in the plain there, the Salt Plain. The word itself means little. Zoar means little. That's the place that Lot fled with his daughters. Remember, having left Sodom after the destruction of Sodom? And they left and went to the hill country because they didn't feel safe in Zoar. Well, anyway, that's where Jehoram and the Edomites fought. It says in verse 21, his troops fled to their tents. There's a question, is that does the his refer to the Israelite troops or the Edomite troops? We're going to assume. Well, John Gill says the Edomites' troops fled. Adam Clark says no, Jehoram's army fled. I think it was probably Jehoram's army. It sounds like it to me. So they failed to put down the rebellion of Edom, and Edom stayed in rebellion. So Jehoram, once again, because of his idolatry, has screwed up. 2 Kings 8, 23 through 24. The rest of the events of Jehoram's reign, along with all his accomplishments, are written in the historical record of Judah's kings. Jehoram rested with his fathers and was buried with his fathers in the city of David, and his son Ahaziah became king in his place. His doings are recorded in the historical record of Judah's kings. I like that. That's how the Holman Christian Study Bible translates that. A lot of places just say in the Chronicles of Judah's Kings, and that makes it confusing because then you think it's the canonical book of Chronicles, which it's not, according to John Gill. So we don't know what else bad King Jehoram did. He rested with his fathers and was buried. That was in 841. His son Ahaziah took over in 841. Now, his son Ahaziah is not the same Ahaziah as Ahab's first son Ahaziah, who ruled in the northern kingdom of Israel. You have to distinguish those two. So this is the southern Ahaziah. It's easy to remember him because he only lived for 1 year. We'll see in the next chapter he's going to get bumped off. Little interesting comment about his burial. Kings doesn't say anything about it except he was buried in the city of David. The city of David is Mount Zion, that little tongue of land that shoots out from Mount Moriah down between the Tarpeian Valley and the Kidron Valley and the Hidron Valley on the south. The Valley of Hinnom on the south. The city of David, he was buried there, and that's where all the city of David is where all the kings were buried. But we go to Chronicles and learn this interesting fact about his burial, 2 Chronicles 21, verse 19, second part of the verse through verse 20. But his people did not hold a fire in his honor like the fire in honor of his fathers. Jehoram was 32 years old when he became king. He reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. He died to no one's regret and was buried in the city of David, but not in the tombs of the kings. So, yeah, he was buried in Mount Zion in the city of David, but they didn't put him in the tomb of the kings because nobody regretted his death. He had no honor. They must have had some kind of bonfire to honor kings when they died. They didn't do that for him. So they showed him great dishonor upon his death. His son Ahaziah, verse 24, takes over. We get a little more detail about that in 2 Chronicles 22:1. Then the inhabitants of Jerusalem made Ahaziah, his youngest son, Jehoram's youngest son, Ahaziah, was made king in Jehoram's place. For the band of men who came with the Arabs to the camp had slain all the older sons. Remember, Arabs near the country of Cush had come in along with the Philistines. Well, these Arabs had wiped out all of Jehoram's older sons, leaving a younger son, the youngest son, Ahaziah, alive. So Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. And we'll talk about him in our next chapter. He's not going to reign long. He's going to reign in the year 841 and get killed before the end of the year is out. Now, the book of Chronicles has another name for Ahaziah, the one-year wonder. 2 Chronicles calls him Jehoahaz. 2 Chronicles 21:17, and they, the same Philistines and the Arabs near the country of Cush that I just talked about, they came against Judah and invaded it and carried away all the possessions found in the king's house, together with his sons and his wives. I mean, Jehoram, very unhappy reign. He got plundered, lost his sons, lost his wives, lost all his possessions, so that no son was left to him except Jehoahaz, and Jehoahaz is another name for Ahaziah, the youngest of his sons. We go now to 2 Kings 8, verses 25 through 27. We go now to verse 25. In the 12th year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, began to reign. Now, to keep all these people straight, Joram is the northern king who ruled from 852 to 841 in his 12th year. If you subtract the dates out, you get the 12th year, and you will see Ahaziah begin to rule, 841. He was the one-year wonder. So Joram, the son of Ahab, in his 12th year, we've got Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram of the south, ruling in 841. Jehoram, his father, had ruled from 848 to 841. Now Ahaziah takes over. Verse 26, Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king, and he reigned 1 year in Jerusalem. That's the way you remember him. He's the one-year wonder. The northern Ahaziah was a two-year wonder, and he fell through the lattice and died. The southern Ahaziah was a one-year wonder, and his mama's name was Athaliah. That's another good way to remember him. His mother's name was Athaliah, the granddaughter of Omri, king of Israel. He walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did evil in the sight of the Lord. Ahaziah did like the house of Ahab had done, because he, Ahaziah, was a son-in-law of the house of Ahab. All right, so let's go through some genealogy here. How is Ahaziah the son-in-law of the house of Ahab? Well, let's back up to the time of Ahab. Ahab had two sons. The first son, Ahaziah, fell through the lattice. He ruled from 853 to 852. And then the second son, Joram, ruled from 852 down to 841. And those two kings, the sons of Ahab, had a sister named Athaliah, a very bad woman. Athaliah was married off to Jehoram when Ahab in the north and Jehoshaphat in the south wanted to make a military alliance. They sealed that alliance with a marriage alliance. And so Ahab's daughter, Athaliah, married Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. Now, Jehoram and Athaliah had a son named Ahaziah, the southern one-year wonder. And Omri, of course, is Ahab's father. So Athaliah is the granddaughter because Omri had Ahab. Ahab married Jezebel, and they had Athaliah. So it went from Omri to Ahab to Athaliah. And then Athaliah marries Jehoshaphat's son Jehoram in the south. Now, Ahaziah, the one-year wonder, walked in the way of the house of Ahab and did evil in the sight of the Lord like the house of Ahab had done. In other words, he put idols up. Why did he do it? Because he was a son-in-law of the house of Ahab. As I've just described, he was married into the pagan family. It says in verse 26 that Ahaziah was 22 years old when he became king. There's a big textual problem here. Many versions say he was 42 years old. The ASV, the Amplified, Green's Literal, English Revised Version, the KJV say he was 42. The New King James footnote says he's 42. The Revised Standard Version footnote says he's 42. or 22 gives you an option. Some LXX, some Septuagint manuscripts in the Syriac say 22, according to the NIV footnote. The Masoretic text say 42. The Holman Christian Study Bible, the ESV, the New Century Version say 42. Who cares? He was either 22 or 42 years old. I don't know. We go now to 2 Kings 8, verses 28 through 29, and we will finish this chapter. Then he, that's Ahaziah, who ruled in 841 for 1 year only in the south. He went with Joram, that's the northern son of Ahab, ruled from 852 to 841. Now let me stop right here. Joram is the uncle of Ahaziah, the southern Ahaziah, the one-year wonder Ahaziah. Joram is uncle. I'm going to call him Uncle Joram and nephew Ahaziah. How is that? Because Joram's sister is Athaliah. Athaliah marries Jehoram in the south, and Athaliah and Jehoram have Ahaziah. So Ahaziah's mother is Athaliah, and Athaliah's brother is Joram. Let me say that again. Ahaziah, the southern king, is married to Athaliah, who is from the north, and whose brother is Joram, who's now ruling in northern Israel. I know this is extremely complicated. It's about to drive me crazy, but that's the way it is. Now, Uncle Joram and nephew Ahaziah go to war against Hazael, the same Hazael we've talked about earlier in this chapter, the one who smothered his boss, his king, Ben-Hadad II. This is the same Hazael who ruled from 841 to 801. Now, this Hazael, king of Aram, went to war with Joram, Uncle Joram, and nephew Ahaziah at Ramoth-Gilead. Now, this is another battle. Ramoth-Gilead was a big city. It was on the king's highway on the way from Damascus as it went down through the Transjordan area. At this battle, the Syrians wounded Joram. So northern King Joram is wounded. So King Joram returned to be healed in Jezreel of the wounds which the Arameans had inflicted on him at Ramoth-Gilead when he fought against Hazael, king of Aram. Then Ahaziah went to see his uncle. Ahaziah, the son of Jehoram, king of Judah, went down to see Joram, the son of Ahab, in Jezreel because he was sick. So the nephew goes to see his uncle. You notice that Joram quit ruling in 841, and Ahaziah only ruled for 841. That should give you a hint as to something bad's about to happen. Well, we'll have to wait the next chapter to see what that is. Now, Joram going up to Jezreel to visit his sick uncle, Joram, Ahaziah going to Jezreel to see his sick uncle Joram was a part of God's plan to destroy Ahaziah. We read in 2 Chronicles 22:7, Ahaziah's downfall came from God when he went to Joram. When Ahaziah arrived, this is in Jezreel, when Ahaziah arrives to see Joram, he went out with Joram to meet Jehu, son of Nimshi, whom the Lord had anointed to destroy the house of Ahab. Now this Jehu was a mean guy, and we're going to see in the next chapter that Ahaziah and Joram going out to meet Jehu has bad consequences, all of which happened in 841, the year that Joram and Ahaziah quit ruling their respective kingdoms, uncle and nephew. So we'll see that in our next chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.